You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Jonathan Capehart sitting in for Leonard Lopate. Don't be deceived by the title Roxane Gay has chosen for her debut story collection, Difficult Women, because the female characters whose lives play out in these stories could all be more accurately described as smart, strong, resilient, or resourceful. In one story, a pair of adult sisters who'd been sexually abused as children form an unbreakable bond to protect each other. In another, a woman who works two jobs to support her unemployed husband, father, and sister, all the while saving money for her own escape. Roxane Gay's earlier books include Untamed State, which was a novel, Bad Feminist, which is a best-selling essay collection, and she's also a co-author of Black Panther, World of Wakanda.
Wakanda.
Got it right. A comic book. Her story collection is published by Grove Press, and as you just heard, I am pleased to have Roxane Gay here in the studio sitting across from me on the show today. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Jonathan.
So why did you call your book Difficult Women?
Well, it was originally called Strange Gods, and then a book came out last year named Strange Gods, and so I started rethinking the title, and I thought about all the women that I write in this novel, in these stories, and they're difficult in one way or another, or people consider them difficult for having opinions and wants and needs, and so, like Bad Feminist, it was a bit tongue-in-cheek, and it was also, I think, just a way of encapsulating the stories of all the women in the book.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been called a difficult woman?
All the time.
And when you're called a difficult woman, what comes to mind for you? Why would someone say that about you?
I'm often called difficult when I don't do what people want me to do, when they've asked something of me, and something generally unreasonable because I tend to say yes to everything. And I say no, and then all of a sudden I'm difficult for not going along to get along. Mm-hmm. And so The more I'm called a difficult woman these days, the happier I am.
And happier you are because that means you are, you're true to yourself.
Yeah, I'm learning how to stand up for myself, which has taken a very, very long time, and I'm still learning, but it's useful.
Now, you've dedicated this book to difficult women. There is one of the stories is Difficult Women. What I love about it is you go through various women who are, I guess, considered difficult.
You've got...
loose women, you have crazy women, you have frigid women, you have, where's the other one? Was there one more crazy? Mothers, and then it ends with dead girls. And what I loved about this is that with each one, you sort of give like a biographical sketch of one. And with loose women, the writing is so, I feel like I am right there sitting next to this person. So on the loose women, you have who a loose woman looks up to. Never her mother. She's trying to kill her mother, or at least those parts of her mother lurking beneath her skin. When she spreads her legs, she hopes the distance between her and her mother will gape ever wider. And then you go on with frigid women. Frigid women. You say that this particular woman, she wanted nothing more than to poke at this sore on her knee, poke it to see how much she could make herself hurt. With each of these descriptions and each of these women, you have a sense that these are people who the public perception of them, at least the characters, is one thing, but how they see themselves is completely different.
Absolutely.
I got that right?
Absolutely. I was definitely in that story very much sending up these ideas that we have about women. I kept noticing that men often call a woman crazy when she like calls the day after they go on a date and, you know, wants to say hello. And they're like, oh man, that crazy bitch is crowding me. And
yeah, you can. It's okay. It's not on the list. I've got a list right here, and I looked. It's not there.
As soon as I said, I was like, ooh, I'm telling. And so I was thinking about these ideas that we have about women when we're doing, frankly, normal things. But they're things that make people uncomfortable. They're things that, you know, require consideration. And so I thought I would write about what these women are actually like versus the labels that they're given. Mm-hmm. And it was a really fun thing to do. And That was one of my favorite stories.
I'm speaking with Roxane Gayen about her collections of short stories called Difficult Women, and we're talking about the specific chapter, Difficult Women. And under Crazy Women, you do have the situation where the woman goes on a date with a guy. It's an okay date, but, you know, and she leaves the apartment, and she realizes she leaves her briefcase on a sofa. So she's calling him, furiously trying to get this briefcase. He's meanwhile telling his friends, like, this crazy bee is calling, blowing up my phone. She goes to his house. Like, from his perspective, she's bananas. She goes in like, I'm just here to get my briefcase. And she walks out with her head held high.
Correct. I mean, it's not that deep sometimes. Men, not all men, tend to really read into the motivations of women, which is, and is it so bad that you go on a nice date and someone wants to talk to you afterward? Like, when did that become a bad thing? I think, you know, the older I get, the more I realize, let's just stop with the games. Let's just be real. And so this is just a woman trying to get her briefcase because she needs to go to work and there are important papers in it. And a guy is avoiding her phone calls like, oh, my God, heaven forbid, I have to speak to the woman I want to have sex with.
Now, the last difficult woman you have here, and it surprised me because it was so short and it was dead girls.
Yes.
And you say death makes them more interesting. Death makes them more beautiful. It's something about their bodies on display in final repose, eyes wide open, lips blue, limbs stiff, skin cold. Finally, it might be said, they are at peace. That last line just it hit me like a ton of bricks because I think I get what you're getting at in that last line. But talk about that.
Yeah, I definitely was getting at two things with that. I think a lot about the cult of the dead girl and how in a lot of popular culture we eroticize a dead woman's body. And it becomes the mainstay of a lot of procedural dramas like Criminal Minds, the CSI shows, Law and Order. And it seems like we almost prefer our women dead. And they're displayed really prettily. And I had read a really great essay by Jessa Crispin, who wrote about the dead girl for The Smart Set, an online magazine out of Drexel University. And I just thought, oh, she's so onto this. It's a really important thing about the ways in which we revere dead women. And at the same time, I think that in death, that might be the only time some women get peace from the realities of this world.
Well, see, that, and that's what I was thinking of, that they are at peace from the catcalls, from the objectification, from the violence, physical violence, sexual violence, and you write a lot about a lot of the women in these stories in some form or another have been sexually abused or sexually violated. Why is that such a big part of, or, well, actually, is it? It's not really a big part in a lot of the stories. It's just sort of there.
Correct. I don't think it's a big part of a lot of the stories, but we live in a world where many women have been subjected to some form of sexual violence. And so I wanted to acknowledge that. And so I can't write a fictional world that doesn't acknowledge the realities that women face. And so some of the women in my stories have experienced sexual violence. And it is fiction, but having been a survivor of sexual violence, it is an obsession of mine. And, they, you know, in many ways, I'm writing the same story over and over again, but hopefully in new and different ways. And so I just, it's an obsession of mine.
And as you're writing, and you just said you're a victim of sexual violence and you seem to be writing the same story over and over again. Are you writing parts of your story over and over again?
No, definitely not. With very few exceptions. In general, I mean, I've been in therapy for so long that I've worked through most of my issues. And so now I'm just thinking about the ways in which violence affect a woman's life. And so in a lot of these stories, it's what happens next? What does the aftermath look like? And so it's not about my story, but it's just thinking about womanhood and the kinds of things that we take for granted about women's experiences. Of course, this is not to say that sexual violence defines women's lives or that all women are subjected to sexual violence, because there are many women who have not experienced sexual violence. And I hope to get to a time when all women know nothing of sexual violence.
Now, this is a collection of stories.
Yes.
And as I said in the intro, you've done like essay collections. You've done a novel. You've done a comic book. Mm-hmm. I know you were the best American. You won the Best American Sex Writing Award in 2012. The Best American Mystery Stories in 2014. You're still an op-ed contributor to mm-hmm. the New York Times.
I am.
To me, what that says is you love writing.
I do.
There's no particular genre of writing that is your focus. If it involves writing, you're going to do it.
I'm going to try. You know, I love writing. It makes me happy. I'm not one of those writers for whom it's torturous or misery, though I do have times when it's torture and misery. But in general, you know, it just makes me happy. I think it keeps me on an even keel. It's probably some self-medication in part. And I love exploring different genres. I love the idea that I can try anything. The only genre I don't write in is poetry.
Have you tried?
Oh, yeah, I have. It's tragic. Tragic. When I was like a teenager, a late teenager, I think I was 19, I wrote a poem called Tears. I actually wrote an essay about this that's in the current issue of Poetry. And it was called Tears, and that's exactly what I think the first line was, I am full of tears. It's so bad. And even today, I would write the same kind of poem. I just don't have a knack for it, but I love reading it. And I think it's good to just not do everything.
Not do everything. So,
I know, you know,
so the one thing you don't
I'm
do
gonna
is
stay in my poems. Lane. Yes.
In your lane, which is like it's like
a
seven lane highway.
It is. But poetry, I'm going to just leave to the poets who mm-hmm. are far better than me.
Well, I can't end this interview without talking to you a little bit about politics.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think you've expressed doubts about the upcoming Women's March, mm-hmm. Which is scheduled the day after Donald Trump is inaugurated as president of the United States. You're not convinced that anything will be accomplished by this, are you?
It's not that. I you know, as we were discussing earlier, what happens next? What do we do with all of this energy that we're going to generate at the march? How are we going to translate that into working against the abhorrent policies that we are absolutely certain are coming from Donald Trump and this bizarre cabinet that he's assembled? Already we can see what the Senate did last night with a midnight vote to begin the process of repealing Obamacare. And so I think we have to be vigilant. And I worry that a lot of the energy is going to be spent on the march. And then that's it. It's going to be this symbolic moment. And I think people need the symbolic moment. They
sure.
need to feel like they're contributing to some sort of political action. But I don't know that this is the way to go about it. And that's just my nature. But I understand why people are going.
Well, then what would you advise folks to do who go to Washington? Mm-hmm. And great, you've got the symbolic moment. You've marched in however many numbers there will be. But then folks go home.
Correct.
So then what would you advise them to do once they go home?
I think that once everyone goes home on November and on
January 22nd,
I think that we have to remember that we have to be vigilant. I would love to see more people running for local elections and getting involved in their communities and volunteering in their communities and volunteering with programs that are helping the marginalized and the people who are going to be most affected by a Donald Trump presidency. And I think the vulnerable are going to need our help more than ever. And they're going to need it to be more than marching. They're going to need money. They're going to need advising. They're going to need mentorship and material support. And so I encourage everyone to think of ways in which they can contribute material support and not just symbolic support.
I wish we had more time.
So
we could talk more about your book. I've been speaking with the award-winning novelist, essayist, not poet, and professor Roxane Gay. Her latest book is Difficult Women. Roxane will be speaking tonight at the 92nd Street Y at 7:30 p.m. For more information, visit our show page at wnyc.org/lowpaid. Thanks, Roxane, so much for joining us
today.
Thank
you, Jonathan.